Introducing a man who played 180 games for Warrington, scoring a staggering 120 tries. Only four players at Wyatt in their entire era of Super League have scored more tries than him. His career may show that literally he may not have been large in stature, but there's no doubt when you take a look back at his scoring achievements, metaphorically, he's a giant of the club. Also went on loan to Harlequins, remember them, a cameo appearance at Swinton before leaving the Wyatt, still turning in 47 games for Wakefield, before an additional 42 games for Rochdale. Not forgetting representing England under-17s, three England Academy caps, three Challenge Cup winners medals, and appearing in two Super League Grand Finals. It's a pleasure to welcome to the podcast, Chris Riley.
Some good stats there.
Brilliant, aren't they? I mean, we sort of wanted you on for quite a while, mate, because we've looked at your stats and we thought there's clearly a reason to get you on because you are such a prolific try scorer. First of all, where did rugby league start for you? Was it watching Warrington first or was it playing rugby league first?
I started quite late, nine or ten. I got brought up with rugby with my dad's side. Funny enough, there's a mix. Most of my family are Warrington, born and bred, support Warrington. But my granddad was born in Goulburn, and my dad's a Wigan fan as well. We've had some mental battles over my career. Funny enough, I did support Wigan when I was younger.
Stop the podcast now, lads.
Obviously, you were going down the wrong path. When did you see the light?
Well, actually, it's when I did start began to play rugby league at a club called Longshore Street, which is Dalham and Busey based in Warrington. All the lads supported Warrington, so it was very hard for me to turn up in my Wigan jersey
and
take the flat that I did take. They had some fantastic red-haired players,
right?
In terms of Brett Dallas, Chris Radlinski was two of my favourite players, so I kind of based my game around them too because I was obviously a Wingham/fullback.
Yeah.
It was only when I started playing probably for Warrington that I truly started getting the love for the club. Obviously being a hometown lad and just seeing how much it meant to everyone and around Warrington and the club and including myself, really, to be fair.
And you went to school in what, Penkuth, Chris? So Penkuth's like a little bit Widnes as well, isn't it? You've had a bit of sort of Widnes and Warrington there at the school.
Don't really talk about Widnes, but it was funny though because I went to Dalham Primary School and Penkuth High School was one of the connection schools to Dalham and the other school was William Beaumont. And William Beaumont was a stone throw away for me to get to school. And it had the best rugby scholarships going on there. But because I was such a softie when I was so young, I thought, I don't want to go to William Beaumont. I'll probably get bullied there. So I chose to go to Penkuth and take a big bus journey up to Penkuth. But it kind of works out really well for me because although Penkuth's not been known for its rugby and its sports in terms of winning things. When I went to Penkuth High School, we had a really good school year. I think we won the school final 4 out of 5 years that I was there. So we achieved some good things even at an early days with such a good group of lads.
Did you get around a lot? How did you get around? Did you get around on a scooter? Because I just noticed that picture behind you there. You got a Vespa on the wall.
I just walked everywhere. I think that's why I was so fit. I had a mum and dad that never drove, and I didn't pass my driving test till about 22.
Late developer.
It's a funny old story because Matty Blythe, who's played for Warrington, he used to pick me up most days for training. He still say I owe him about £6,000 in petrol money. he owes that against me now, so it's a funny old story that we carry on now. But I used to just walk around everywhere.
And when you were playing rugby at school, Chris, were you always a winger? Because I had it down somewhere I read that you were a fullback. You started off at fullback.
Played probably the wing and fullback wherever was needed, to be honest. My love for the position was probably fullback.
Right.
I played a lot of fullback during my time in academy.
Yeah.
I think I played for the England under-17s as a fullback.
Yeah.
It was only early doors in my career that I started to push more towards the wing. I think the game around fullback, the evolution of the fullback role changed. It became from being more of a, you know, safe under the high ball, defensively sound, returning the balls back well, but then it became more of a half-back role. And don't get me wrong, I'm not the worst passer in the world, but I didn't really have the niche to, you know, put people through gaps or throwing that 30-yard pass like someone like Brett Hodgson or Richie Mavis did. It just really suited my game to play on the wing. And, you know, Tony Smith was great for me when I started to evolve my game in terms of, you know, coming in the field a bit more and, you know, searching for the ball rather than, you know, just scooting all the time.
Yeah. And when you were young, were you a little bit smaller than everyone else? Did everyone leave you behind, or has it always been that way through your rugby career?
I think it's always been a struggle for me, to be honest. I've always been a very skinny lad growing up. I found it really tough. I was quick. I loved scoring tries. But as soon as I got tackled, I was down, probably injured or crying to my mum. But yeah, I felt when I first kind of broke through the first time, I think it was in 2005 or 17.
Right.
I wasn't full-time then. But I felt like a bit of a young boy in a man's world. I just felt it took the time for my body to, you know, put some muscle on you know, a bit of fat as well.
So do you think that's a little bit similar to Matty Ashton? I mean, looking at Matty Ashton at the moment, I mean, he's rapid, but he's like a rake, isn't he, at the moment?
You know, you can't help people's DNA, and, you know, some people are meant to be skinny, some people are meant to be fat, and some people are more muscly than others. But I think with Matty Ashton, you know, I think similar to myself, we run above our weight. We have both got speed. I think, you know, speed in any sport is a massive bonus for anyone. I think that helps. But I think, you know, in time, it'll put a bit of size on it. It'll just only be natural. He's only a young lad like myself. It took me a while to put that weight on and find a way that was more comfortable for myself. Matt has gone from the Championship, which is a really, really tough league. I think he did fantastic. He scored some great tries, poor play. I think only naturally it'll just get better in time. It's just a shame that the injury came when it did.
Interesting you say about it took you a couple of years, Chris. And obviously, we're not playing rugby now, but they've reintroduced reserves this year. And part of that was because that step from academy, and whether you're playing under 17s or under 19s, to playing against big, dirty, 30-year-old props in first team, there's no step between the two, is it? It's a big leap from playing against other 18-year-olds to then suddenly playing in the first team.
No, I agree. I was very fortunate to have a system where I was able to step up. I was kind of fast-tracked through them systems where I ended up making my debut at 17. Although that was through, you know, the first team having a lot of injuries, but I was already playing under 21s at 17. So I was already up against, you know, I played against the Wigan side that had Joel Tompkins, Jerry CUCU. There's, you know, a vast of Wigan first team players playing, and I was playing with some players myself like Michael Sullivan, there's Mark Hilton, Danny Lima played for a couple of games. So although it wasn't a full first team fixture in the under 21s game, we was able to have, you know, I think it was up to 5 first team players playing.
Yeah.
Plus there was, you know, a handful of players that was ready to play.
And were you always sort of destined to go to Warrington, Chris? You know, when you were coming up as a junior, was it Warrington that showed the interest in you? Was there any other clubs that came along?
Warrington showed the most interest in myself. I think there was a bit of talk about St. Helens at the time. But other than that, I think I signed at, I was 15, 16, and I signed for Warrington. So it kind of went really well for me there. And then it kind of just snowballed from, you know, from being 16 to the next minute I was making my debut against Huddersfield at 17. So then the following year, I signed a contract to become full-time. So, there was no full interest that I fully knew of. But, you know, I think there's a little bit of talk about St. Helens, but that could be wrong. You know, it's probably a bit of hearsay. But I never really had anyone contacting me going, you know, we want you to serve. It was mainly Warrington showed the best interest.
So it was Paul Cullen that gave you your debut. Do you remember much about that debut?
Yeah. You know, it was such a great feeling the week leading up. It was funny enough, really, I was training at Wilspool. It was the week leading up to St. Helens. I think the game was at Knowsley Road, and I was having an ice bath at the time. And Paul Cullen come up and he was like, "Listen, we might need you to play this week, so make sure you prepare yourself. And if you don't play this week, you're going to play next week against Huddersfield for definite." So, as you can imagine, I'm in the ice bath and shivering as it is, but then I started shivering because the nerves started kicking and thinking that, "Oh my God, I'm 17. I could be playing against St. Helens, like one of probably the best teams in the world." It didn't pan out that way, lucky enough. But, you know, it's fantastic that I played against Huddersfield, you know, reaching probably my goal that I set all my life for a long, long time to make it at the highest level. And, you know, it was fantastic. You know, I think I got looked after really well because like I said, I felt like a bit of a young boy in a man's world, but I had Nathan Wood and Toa Coilove on the inside of me. So
So Toa Coilove was your centre, was he? He was your centre that day. Gee. And who was the, do you remember who the opposing winger was? Do you remember who you were up against from the other team?
I think it was a player called Paul White.
Right.
You know, I think he was quite experienced. He wasn't the biggest of wingers. But, you know, I think it was just a tough game all round. I was very nervous. I got bombed all day and all night. I think I come up with a couple of mistakes, but it's part of the process, you know, you build yourself up for this massive thing, and then it's been and gone, and you know, it was fantastic. You know, I wish I could relive it again.
Yeah.
And with the experience and the knowledge that I've got now, but you know, it happened, and you know, I moved on, and you know, had a successful career moving forward.
So talking about experience, those first few years, I think you played 3 games in the first year, and then you played 4 in the second year before you sort of established yourself, progressing into 2007 and 2008. What did you learn in those few years? What kind of different player were you from that first season in comparison to that third or fourth season?
You know, when you're playing against players that are similar to your age and probably quality, you can stand out a bit more. It was about, for me, you know, I knew I had to build some size on me to cope with, you know, coming up against grown men week in, week out. I think the impact, I was very probably fragile coming through that process. But it was just about learning how I could handle myself in them sort of scenarios. Mentally, I was always there, but physically, it took me a long time. So I think it was just a timing game. Paul Cullen gave me a lot of time to build, to get better. And, you know, I'm very thankful that he gave me that opportunity to come in the first team, to train full time, to build myself up. So I think a lot of credit has to go to Paul. You know, I always wanted to play more games, but I was happy just to be in and around the first team, around experienced players, staff members. Paul Derbyshire, God bless his soul, was fantastic for me, and probably Kev Penny as well.
Yeah.
And then me and Kev used to be around like the England youth team, and then obviously all the lads would be, you know, either internationals or off season. As soon as we finished our England youth, Paul Derbyshire would have us into training,
right,
and not us have any breaks. So we'd go to David Lloyd's. Obviously, as you can imagine, me and Kev was very happy about that. Not
bit posh, bit posh.
But yeah, you know, it's I can't afford that now. No, Paul was fantastic. He took his out of his own time to come and train me and Kev up, do a lot of weights, and try and shove loads of protein down us.
He seems very serious, though, Chris, doesn't he, Paul Cullen? He's very intense.
You know what? In and around, you know, probably games and you know, he's very passionate to the club. He's a wanting lad. He knows what it means. So I think he shows that, and I think, you know, he can be very, very serious. But, you know, for me, Paul was a great mentor. He, you know, he gave me time to nurture, and, you know, he helped me with my game and improve my, probably my mentality and my game at an early age. But yeah, he could blow his load. I think when you blow your load so many times, it only has an effect so much. I think after time, it doesn't really work as much.
Yeah, and of course with Paul, I guess he's come from a similar path to you, hasn't he, Chris? That, you know, he's been born and bred in Warrington. So you coming through, he's probably not too different to the way that he portrayed himself when he sort of came into the Warrington team.
Yeah, it was obviously two totally different players. You know, Paul was a very, very tough guy, and he brought that sort of mentality into his playing career. Never took a backward step. You know, I've seen some highlights of his career. You know, he was full throttle. different player. But I think the thing that we both had in common was the passion for the club, wanting to win, and never die attitude. You know, I think wanting to see the club being successful. And I think that's what we both really, you know, really wanted. And you know, to Paul's credit, he brought in a lot of young Warrington lads. Through a small period there, that went on to have you know, successful careers. And Steve Pickskill was one who made a good handful of games before moving on to Widnes. You know, myself, Matty Blythe, Lee Mitchell, Kev Penny. There's probably a few more that I've not really mentioned there, but I didn't really see a lot of Warrington lads getting, if not the chance, but you know, they didn't really progress as well into Super League. Yeah. I think we're seeing a lot more Warrington lads based, even if they moved on to other clubs nowadays.
So then, you know, stepping forward in those 4 years and you've started to do the weight gaining and everything else and you're doing the weights, there's been a little bit of criticism in Australia recently that a few of the wingers here have almost put on too much muscle and have lost a little bit of speed. Were you as quick at 22 as you were at 17? Once you put that weight on, did you still feel you had that pace that you had as that sort of whippersnipper at 17 years of age?
You know, it's a funny one, really, because I think I still always, in my head, felt like it was quick.
Yeah.
But I think I probably lost a little bit of speed, but the power came with it.
Were you processed on that? I mean, were you sort of given speed tests? Were you given a 60 metres and given a time each year before the start of the season?
We used to do little short runs, yeah. We used to have these timing gates.
Yep.
5 metres, 10 metres. We'd go up to, you know, probably like 50 metres.
Yeah.
We never really do times over 100 metres. But, yeah, we used to have short gates where we'd get timed and, you know, I'd always be around near the top between myself, Kev Penny and a few others at the time.
Yeah.
I was always quick and I never really lost that speed. If anything, I kind of was quicker off the mark and more explosive because that was the kind of training that I was given.
Yeah, yeah.
More towards when I started to play on the wing. So I lost me more, probably more of my endurance of running around at fullback and being involved in, you know, one out of every two plays, you know, getting the ball kicked to me more often than not.
Yeah.
To then playing on the wing. And it was more about making my time more positive on the wing. So when I come in, it was all about being explosive, trying to break the line.
Yeah.
And leave plays on the floor. So yes, I did adapt in time as time went on.
Do you think also, I mean, just keeping on the speed theme, you look at 100 metres runners and you look at who's won gold medals at the Olympics and they're all almost pushing 30, 31, 32 at times when they take out that gold medal. It seems they get quicker as they progress through the career. But that doesn't seem to be the same with rugby league players. Do you think there's a certain age where the speed goes in rugby league? Is it sort of, you know, 28, 29, it's starting to disappear? Jonathan Davis, who we had on the BBC podcast the other day, said when he was 31 at Warrington, he had one of his best seasons. He had lost a yard of pace. Did you feel it towards the end of your career that it was just starting to go a bit?
Yeah, I think so. I think in rugby league, with the impacts that you take on the physical training.
Yeah.
No, I get the comparison compared to, you know, sprinters, but they don't have to put their bodies through what we do as rugby league on a daily basis, never mind the impacts of what we get on the weekend.
Did you notice a difference in diet as well? I mean, as you've progressed through your career, I mean, at 17, you're just eating fish and chips all the time. I mean, was it in the game then, back then, at that sort of early days of Super League?
You know what? I've always been quite questioned over my diet, so it's probably a touchy subject. This.
You've been to see Benny Westwood, haven't you?
I'm probably worse than Benny Westwood, to be honest, with his spam butters. I'd always whacking a lot of weight, especially when from about age of 23 to 24. Probably not dreaded it, but you know, Ben Harrison would put a lot of weight on, but he would train it hard and strip that off and look fantastic by the time the season started.
Yeah.
Probably like myself and Chris Bridge, probably one of the best that I've played with.
Yeah.
So, you know, just unselfish. He would just, you know, probably pass you the ball when he could score tries. He'd always make the winger look good.
He was almost
probably a few.
He almost looked lazy, didn't he? He almost looked lazy in the way he played because he had so much style, Chris Bridge. You know, it was almost complacent the way he sort of went about that sidestep, and he could throw a pass. You must have played with a lot of different centres. How long does it take before you start feeling comfortable with the lad inside you?
I think it takes time to get it perfected. It's only natural, like the chemistry builds in time.
Yeah.
Because naturally, sometimes you might bounce off certain centres and, you know, you learn the moves, how they want to play, how they step, or if they step with the left foot or the right foot, if they like to flick, if they like to drop you off. You know, these sort of things take time to build, but with training with the boys, you know, week in, week out, it kind of comes quite quick. But if you get a good run in the team, you know, I think like myself and Ryan Atkins, I think we came up one season, I think we almost scored 30 tries each.
Yeah, on the
left side. So it shows you how lethal that side got at one stage. And that's, you know, with a couple of seasons together, playing well, learning each other's moves and, you know, just building that bond together as well. I think that's important, that, you know, you know that. I know that Ryan Atkins would have, you know, done anything for me in a game and I would have done anything for him to to get that success.
Well, to back that up, Chris, and this is courtesy of Sam to provide these stats. Your stats are absolutely incredible. From 2008 to 2013, you played 143 games and scored 99 tries. You were scoring a try every 1.4 games. There's hardly anyone at Warrington who's achieved that. You were scoring a try every 115 minutes. So looking at that era, between 2008 and 2013, is that just Ryan Atkins, or is that Matty King as well outside you?
Matt King first year, I think. Matt King was 2008, and then Ryan Atkins onwards, I think.
I just think not so much just the centres either. I think, you know, the centres got to get a lot of credit. Played outside Gleeson, Chris Bridge, Simon Griggs, Ryan Atkins, Matt King, you know, fantastic players. I think when you look at that era of like 2008 till the end, I was blessed to be playing with some fantastic players. In that process, we had, you know, Richie Mathers at fullback, Brett Hodgson, probably the best fullback that I've ever played with. You know, I've seen some highlights where I've seen Brett Hodgson just put the ball straight across the centre to me. And making me look, making me look like a good player.
It's Griggs who finds Michael Monaghan again. Here is Bridge in centre field. And Bridge will attack this line, gets the pass all along the ground to Riley. And Riley's in for the first try!
One thing we keep forgetting is that between Paul Cullen and Tony Smith, there was James Lowes. He came in for, I think it was about 16 games. Did you just feel he was the caretaker coach? Did you feel that it was just a case that he was just filling in the boots for Tony until he arrived?
Well, Jimmy Lowes, I think for me, I've got to give a lot of credit to Jimmy. He gave me a good chance in that season where he was put in charge. Although we didn't start the season great, I think that was a very good turning point for myself. I started at fullback.
Right.
And I had a good couple of first games, although still a bit fragile, still needed probably a bit more weight on me. With Jimmy's guidance, he made me feel like I was the best player. One-on-one coaching was fantastic. It would make me feel $1 million. I'd come into training, or you're putting some size on there, Chris, you're looking good.
Yeah.
Just little subtle things that would mentally, do me good for training. And then in the games, like, right, you're going to win us the game today. You're going to come up with a winning try for us today. Just little things that, maybe other people didn't know he did with me, but, I'm sure he did that with other players. I just felt at the time as a team and as a collective, it was probably a bit too early for a big job for Jimmy.
Right.
I think Jimmy will make a fantastic coach in the near future, but I don't know which way Jimmy wants to go. I know he's been involved in rugby union over the last few years, but I think it was just a bit too early at the time. So I think Tony Smith coming in and then Jimmy going down to assistant worked really, really well.
And was there any sort of inkling that you would stay at fullback, or was it just a case of that you're going back on the wing, Chris? Who came in and took your place at number one?
Yeah, I started at fullback. Tony gave me a few games, and then he brought in Richie Mathers.
Yeah. Right.
I think Richie Mathers came in. I think we lost Martin Gleeson.
Was it a surprise when Martin Gleeson went? I mean, that was a bit of a shock for everyone, I think, when he left, because he was in such great form at the time, or just didn't fit with Tony Smith.
To a certain degree, I don't know personally if he didn't have a good relationship with Tony, or if he just wanted to change. But I think with Martin, I think when the move to Wigan came along, I think.
Yeah.
I think in his head he couldn't turn that move down. Tony's had an eye on what he really wanted as well and what he felt was going to be an improvement. He worked with Richard Mathers.
Chris, did he need to change the culture when he came in? Because you said he came in and said this is how it's going to be. Was there a culture that existed that had maybe tailed off a bit in discipline or something like that?
As a young lad coming through, you hear all these rumours about the lads are out drinking all the time, and even if they lost games, they'd still be out drinking. And it's probably to a certain degree, there was a bit of a drinking culture, but not as the game started to evolve a bit, so players started to be more professional. There probably was still that, hiccup and mistake from certain individuals, including myself. I wasn't, perfect through that early age. So I think with Tony Smith coming in, he had to put a bit of a rubber stamp on things to this is how things are going to go moving forward.
Did he look you in the eye when he was giving you this?
Like I said, he's a very calm, collected person, very smart person. For me, he was just probably the best coach that I've been around for on the field and off the field. I had a lot of issues that not a lot many people know that he helped me with a lot. You know what? I think I'll say I lost my mum in 2009, Christmas Day. You know what? And I think he was just fantastic. He never put any pressure on me during that period. If anything, he just said, you know, you take as much time as you need. And it worked. You know, I think he just said, like, listen, when you come to rugby, make this your safe haven. You know, leave all your troubles outside the field. Come in, get your job done. And then if you ever need me, I'll always be here at the end of the phone call. You know, and know what he was. He was fantastic for me. He helped me build my game. So I'll give a lot of credit to Tony Smith.
You know, going through such an emotional time of losing your mum, did you feel more safe on the field than you did away from the game?
Because obviously, my mum on Christmas Day 2009, and then that following season, I had the birth of my first child, Isabella. And I think 2010 was probably one of my best seasons in a wire jersey. And it, you think in certain sorts of them sort of certain circumstances, losing your mum, or you know, the day that I lost my mum on Christmas Day, would crumble someone. And it probably did to a certain degree for a couple of weeks. But rugby just took me away from the real life like it always has done.
Well, you had a blinding year. You scored, you played 29 games and scored 25 tries that year, Chris. You had the number two on your back, but Tony moves you out onto the other wing. Did that suit you? Are you right or left-handed? Was that perfect for you to be on that side?
On the right wing, probably more suited with being a right-handed player. You know, diving into the corners with your right hand out, leading out. But on the left, my game was a lot better. You know, coming in for scoots, I could come in and get involved and step off either foot. My best asset was probably, you know, going in for the corner, was stepping off my left foot. Rather than diving in the corner, I always had the knack of being able to step on my left foot and leave someone flying by.
We had Tommy Liner on the podcast, and he said that he's right-handed and he struggles to put that ball down with the left hand. You know, he's trying to coach himself to get the ball down. But for you, I guess it's going down in the right hand anyway.
Yeah, I think I learnt ways to put myself in situations that would be able to be more right hand dominant. Don't get wrong, I have to sometimes reach out with my left hand. And like Tommy says, it's not as comfortable as it is when you do it with your natural hand. But you somehow try and find a way to get over that line.
Morley on the charge. Great offload to Michael Monaghan. The Huddersfield are just hanging off. They don't know what to do. They're bamboozled by this. Go. It's Brett Hodgson. Infield, it goes to Chris Bridge. Bridge then, off it goes to Myler. They've got two on one out wide. Myler gets the ball wide to Riley.
It's back to six anyway.
He will need another six. It's a second try for Chris Riley.
You play with some great players, Chris, and your stats back up that, you know, occasionally you were sort of seen as the Warrington lad, the lad that was from Warrington. Clearly, there's a different salary structure at Warrington between the superstars that come in and people like yourself, maybe, that have come through the academy system. Did you ever feel that possibly, you know, that salary equated to how many tries you were scoring wasn't quite balanced the way it should be?
You know what? It took me a little while to, you know, probably get what I deserved, personally.
Yeah.
You know, I probably was on a lower salary compared to, you know, if I moved to probably another club. Which I probably had the chance to in 2011 when I went to London.
Right.
I did a month there. And at the time, it was just very tough because I had a missus and daughter at home.
Yeah.
But at the end of the month, I spoke to Tony and he'd explained that, you know, can't guarantee you any game time at this moment in time, but if you'd like to stay in at London, they want to keep you on. And at the time, I think it was a bloke called Rob Powell was the coach at Harlequins.
Right.
And he gave me a phone call and in a month and he was just saying, listen, I know you contracted Warrington, but we'd like to make a move for you.
Yeah.
But at that time, you know, I think it would have been such a big move with moving down south to the capital for me and the missus and the little one.
Yeah.
At the time, it just wasn't very foreseeable for myself.
Yeah.
I think I wanted to come back and be at home around the people that, you know, I needed at that moment in time. And, you know, I came back to Warrington and, you know, I didn't play any games for a long while. It was only towards the back end of the season that I kind of got back in and had a decent run and scored a few tries as well. But going back to what we were saying about the money situation, yeah, it probably took me a while. It was only probably around like the 2010 after that season, I kind of, you know, I got a decent salary.
And is it talked about amongst the players? I mean, you know, I presume if you're playing for Manchester United, everyone's on a shitload of money anyway. But, you know, in rugby league, there certainly does just be a few differentials between marquee players. Now, you didn't really have the marquee players, I guess, when you played. Is it something that's spoken about amongst the players that, you know, or is it just a tight-knit community and it's left to the back of the mind and you just go out on the field together and play?
You know what? It isn't really spoken about unless, you know, like me and Kev Penny would have a chat and, you know, would maybe explain of how much we was on. But it was never like, oh, you're on this money and you're on this amount of money and you don't deserve that sort of money. You know, you get the whispers that, you know, certain players on X amount of money.
Yeah.
And deserve it. So, but on the other hand, no, we didn't really talk about it that much. It's not something that, you know, we know we're not millionaires. We know that a lot of us are going to get a decent earning, live comfortable, but probably have to work when we move on from rugby league. And that's a shame, really, because we put our bodies through such mayhem. you know, some people are not fit and ready to, you know, to work and put their bodies on the line that much. You know, they deserve a break, deserve to be able to retire, you know, and only a handful of players are able to do that.
When you left the game, physicality-wise, I mean, we spoke to John Clark, we said, you know, what kind of effect has it had on him? I mean, you look as fit as a fiddle there. Is it more mental that, you know, that mental aspect of it when you take away from rugby league that's the problem, more than the sort of creaky knees when you leave the game?
He's not stood up yet.
And I won't either. Been to Benny Westwood's food emporium too much. The time when I left, I'm probably a bit different towards some other players. You know, some players leave on their terms. Some players leave because of injury. I left because I think I felt like I lost the love for the sport towards the end.
Right. So that's a good time to leave then?
Probably really in terms of, you know, the way my body feels mentally. I've got two young, healthy children who get to get my time more now. I think towards the back end of Wakefield, I almost quit there to finish the game. It was only that I knew Alan Kilshaw down at Rochdale.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
He said, come down, you know, play a trial game against Salford, which, you know, I was never in shape, but I was up against Justin Kahn. I felt I still did all right. I think I'd had 6 weeks out with no training. And I thought, you know what, I'll continue, although it's part-time. I'll give it another crack and just try and find the enjoyment again for the sport, the love that I've had for such a long time. And I did. You know what, I really enjoyed my time down at Rochdale. We've got a group of lads that are part-time, earning, you know, next to nothing.
Yeah.
But it was just the crack that we had, and we went on to achieve something so special that first season. Although it was only the League One, we was up against a undefeated Toulouse side.
Yeah.
We had to go to their own back garden, and we turned them over in the final. So, you know, a little club like Rochdale that had no hopes and was written off from the start, we went over there and we've got the job done.
Oh, and it's 15 seconds away from going up as champions. This is absolutely unbelievable. And this is wide to west stuff now as Toulouse go back into the middle. Through hands. And it's on. Mingo's in. Mingo's going through. The clock's up. It's over! It's over! It's over! The hoot is gone. Paul Crabb. Yes!
Quite a few lads knocking around in that league, Chris, that could play Super League. I mean, you look down through sort of the path of some of the Warrington players. I mean, Chris Hill that came that way. You now got Matty Ashton. Do you think there are a few lads there that are just sort of going under the radar in that league?
Yeah, definitely. And there could be reasons why they don't always just come in. There's probably interest around there. And like what we spoke about before about the finances, it probably isn't suitable for some of them players in the Championship.
Right.
Some of these lads earn good money doing the jobs that they do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not saying this is the gospel truth because I don't actually know, but I'm guessing some of these players don't want to go to Super League and take a pay cut.
Right. Is there room to do both? Could you do both, though? Could you do both? I mean, did you have to train every day to play Super League? You know, could you hold down a proper job and just sort of train a few times a week and still turn out in Super League?
When you're full-time, you pretty much train every day. You probably get the odd day off in the week.
Yeah.
I think the physical demand that is expected of you to train every day, to go and work, you know, in the afternoon, I don't think that would be plausible.
Right.
To train hard, work, and then expect to play well on the weekend, I just don't think that would happen. Yeah. It's expected of, you know, players in the Championship and League One. And it's really tough. You know, I did two seasons part time, and I think that's what kind of put the nail in the coffin for me, for myself, and the end of my career.
Yeah.
Was the fact that, you know, I found a new line of work that could take me for the rest of my life, which I really enjoy, in the support work.
Tell us about the work you're doing now, Chris. What exactly are you sort of keeping yourself busy with?
I'm a support worker for people with autism. I generally work with young adults. It's just about making an impact on their lives. They're residential, so we're trying to integrate them out into the community, being involved in activities, tasks, even just like subtle little things of going to shopping, doing independent shopping.
And has something taken you down this path? The path that you've taken now, that what you're doing now, did something lead to this? Is the reason why you've gone into this kind of career?
You know what? At the time, I didn't really think about it. It was only because, you know, I've had things that have happened at a younger age. So my brother, Liam, he had a brain tumour when he was 3 years old.
Right.
So I was 8 at the time. He had to go to Alderhay a lot with my mum. Have operations. My time from my mum as well was taken away. So I had to spend a lot of time at my auntie's house, at my nan's house. So I was involved around my brother a lot and seeing him, you know, how tough it was for the family, and, you know, including my brother. He had to wear a helmet at one stage because he lost, you know, the neck muscles. So, you know, he struggled to keep his head up at times.
Yeah.
His learning difficulties through them early years was tough. He was quite aggressive at times. So I think that put me in a place where I truly didn't know at the time, but to where I am now kind of helped me.
Yeah.
So that was one aspect of, you know, I think kind of playing in the role that I'm playing now, and a lot of the work that I did with the Warrington Bulls Foundation, which is a great charity. They do fantastic work in the community of Warrington. Some great people who work there, and I got to be involved in that quite a lot. Also, being a local lad, I wanted to be involved as well. It was I got a lot of it from working in the community and being around people of Warrington. You know, I've got so much satisfaction from that. But it was the stuff that we did with people with difficulties and disabilities that I got more satisfaction from. So I think all the stars have aligned, and it's kind of led me to this where I am now. And that's, you know, working for a great company called Bright Futures, who look after these young adults and children with autism. And you know what? I kind of went in there a little bit naive, thinking, you know, that a lot of these individuals would be very similar. I'm so wrong. they're all so unique. You know, the love that I have for it, it's such a great job. I go in with a big smile on my face. I'm probably a bit too loud and brash for some of the staff members. I probably do their heads in. But you know, it's such a great job. Rewarding. You know, tough at times. It's demanding of what we have to do. Some of these young adults can get quite physical, so you know, we're trained in techniques to help support these young adults. So you know what I don't get from rugby, I get sometimes from the job that I do now, because it can be quite physically demanded on the staff. But you know what, I come in with a big smile on my face and I leave with a big smile.
I was just going to say, Chris, you've got a big smile on your face now. In the whole of this interview, you're smiling more now than about any more of those tries you scored for Warrington. I've got a mate who's been in the sort of corporate world for 20 years, and he's just quit his job about 2 months ago. And he's just started as a care worker. He started 2 days ago, and he sent me a text yesterday. He said he got more satisfaction out of what he was doing yesterday than he's done in 20 years. And I get the impression it's the same for you as well.
I would say similar. I think nothing will ever replace rugby. I'm very proud of what I was able to achieve. You know, I still could be playing now, but I think when you know, and my heart just wasn't in it towards the end. And you know what, I think because I debuted at such an early age, I won the things that I did so early. Maybe that played a part in it, I don't know. But you know what, I look back and, you know, sometimes a bit like, you know, could I, you know, the people of Warrington are my friends, like, are you going to get back playing rugby? Are you going to get back playing? And you know what? If I got myself into some sort of decent nick, I could play in the, you know, the Championship or League One.
Yeah.
But you have to want to do it. If you've not got it in the heart or, you know, in the brain, you just won't go far. And at the minute, it's just not in the heart at the minute. I love rugby league and I'll always watch it. I'll always be involved in some form of aspect of it. Mm. But for this moment in time in my life, it's just not what I want anymore. But with what I'm doing at the minute, it's fantastic.
Good on you, mate. And also, just going back to the Warrington Foundation, Sam, we'll just turn to you for a second. Just repeat what you told me on the phone the other day in regards to what Chris used to do at the Warrington Foundation, possibly.
At the risk of embarrassing him, yeah, I was involved not so much with the foundation, but with the Supporters Trust. And whenever we had meetings or whenever we had events, there was always one person who would show up time and time again without even being asked sometimes. And that was Mr. Chris Riley. Great supporter of the club, a great supporter of the community. And I don't want to embarrass you, mate, but it was noticed. It still is. It's still noticed. Well done.
No, that's, you know, much appreciated. I don't do things like that for recognition, but I think when you do your end of season awards, I think I won the trophy 3 times for the foundation and Supporters yes. Trust. You know, it is nice to get the recognition. I don't do it to get the recognition. And then we're going back to the 2009 Challenge Cup final, which we won. When we came back to the town, oh my God, the scenes, the people of the town. I think there was over 60,000 people across the town. Bank Garden was just absolutely bouncing. You know, to see old men cry, there's older women, there's young children, people learning difficulties, disabilities. You know, just how much it meant to the town. And you know, I think I took that a lot of that pride and passion. Mm. So you know, to be involved in, you know, the Supporters Trust and the Wanton Wolves Foundation, I just took that in my stride.
You mentioned 2009. We've touched on you winning the Challenge Cup 3 times, but of course, you then actually scored at Wembley as well. Just talk us through that immediate buzz for the 10 seconds or a minute immediately after putting the ball down.
As a winger, you want to score tries and you always want to do them at the highest stage. And for me, Wembley's always been one of them where me and my dad used to sit down, you know, even if it was watching Wigan at the time.
Oh, here we go again.
And watch them famous players walk up them steps to win the trophy. But for me to be there and win, and also ultimately it's all about winning, put the personal achievements to the side. If you score, you don't score. It was no better when I scored or when I didn't score. Just winning that illustrious trophy was what meant more than anything. When I lifted that trophy up, when I scored or when I didn't score, it didn't mean any different. I had that Challenge Cup trophy in my hands.
Monaghan again. Behind Ward, into the hands of Hodgson, and left it goes to Atkinson.
Out of all those players, there mustn't be that many who's got 3 Challenge Cup medals.
I think at the time, there's me, I think Lee Breers, has Benny Westwood won 3?
But that would be about it, wouldn't it? Because Ryan Atkins came in after Maddie King.
Did Adrian Morley win all 3? Mickey Hyam?
No, I don't think Mickey Hyam was in for all 3. We'll have to have a look into that and see. But I mean, boy, what a record.
Yeah.
Do they all blend into one? Can you pick them out? Yep. Or are they all just become one memory of the Challenge Cup?
You know what? They all have their own unique meaning. You know, every team was different moving forward through that. So what we went through as a team, each time we won it, was one that was unique and one that can never be done again. But I give one of my medals away to my dad after I think we beat Leeds 2010. I let my dad have that medal. Because although, you know, they look great in your room or wherever you put them out there. But I think just the memory of being there and achieving what we got to achieve will live long ever. You know, I think you know, when you walk around, well, I do anyway, around Warrington, you know, I get pulled up by certain people and, you know, of the community, and it's just nice to talk back and relive them sort of memories again.
Yeah.
You know, it's nice having a little medal that collects dust every now and again, but for me, it's just to have been there and done it was a great achievement, and, you know, I'll die a happy man.
Countdown will begin in a minute. It's a general noise you can hear at the moment, but it will become choreographed in just a moment when the final 10 seconds are shown on the big screen. Here we go. Play on. The Hoot of Wales, Mickey Hyam, soon to be a dad, is a Challenge Cup winner. And all around him, the celebrations in primrose and blue begin. Huddersfield disconsolate. That Wembley turf will still feel so hard as they slump in defeat. But Tony Smith is a Challenge Cup winning coach in his first season in charge of the Warrington Wolves. There has been so much effort and endeavour at that club over recent years. This is one they deserve. You could have made a case for Huddersfield deserving it too, but it is Warrington who come up triumphant in the end.
Lee, many, many congratulations. Can you believe it? You've won the Challenge Cup.
That was awesome. What a game, what a, yeah. Got it at last. The boys. What about the defence in the middle? Oh, my God. My legs are killing, but Ben Westwood could hardly walk. What? All the credit goes out to him. Mike Monahan. He's had his knockers. He's just picked the Lanterne Trophy up. How good's that?
You can see what it means to all these fans as well. Fantastic.
This is going to be unbelievable. We're going to be remembered in Warrington for the rest of our lives. And they're the best fans by a country mile.
Did you learn from each experience? When you went back the second time to win, did you feel more comfortable at Wembley? Was there a difference?
It certainly did help. It did help. I think having the experience of some players that have been there. The first one was obviously a bit of the unknown. I think was it 1990, last time Warrington played at Wembley, which is the old Wembley?
Yeah, against Wigan.
And he got beat by Wigan.
Yeah, we were there.
I think, I was only 2 years old then.
We were there in body, but not really in mind, I think. It's probably the best way to describe it.
I can imagine. But do you know what? I think I've been part of that team that won the first trophy. Was it 35 years?
Something like that, wasn't it? It was a long time between drinks.
Yeah, I think just to get that one off the monkey off the back was just such a great achievement. I think we, as a collective, we knew we had what it took to win it. Yeah. I think we hadn't had such a great season that year. I think Huddersfield was in a bit better form than we was. But we just never really thought about Huddersfield and to a degree what they could really do to us. It was about what we could do on that day. I remember being sat in a meeting maybe a day or two before, and we sat round in a circle, and Tony would ask us to say what we was going to do for the team individually. And that was like, you know, I'm going to get you a quick play of the ball tomorrow. I'm going to score the try. It's going to win us the game tomorrow. I'm going to smash Earl Crabtree tomorrow, which Moz did.
Back comes Adrian Morlick, the Sports Minister Gerry Sutcliffe, awaiting him with that famous old trophy, decorated in the Warrington ribbons. Doug Hoyle there, Baron Hoyle, such a stalwart of the Warrington club. It's taken 35 years for Warrington to get back here, and it will be one of the modern day greats to lift the trophy, Adrian Morlick. It is all sunshine and smiles and primrose and blue, and Lee Breers alongside Adrian Morley, two great servants of this Warrington club, lifting that trophy aloft. It means so much to so many who followed that club and watched them underachieve for so many years to finally taste success again. It's going to be quite some night of partying in a certain town in Cheshire.
Did Cal Fitzpatrick ever want to stick his nose into these sort of meetings and tell you what to do? Because, you know, he's quite opinionated. We've talked to him before.
Carl's a fantastic bloke. You know what? I've got a lot of time for Carl, and I'm sure he's got the same for me. But he wasn't around the club as such around the early days. But I had to play against Carl. I hated him as a player. I felt like he was such a grubbin. You know, I think Paul Cullen wasn't such a big fan of Carl either. I think he scored a hat-trick against Warrington one time. Oh. And he was just dancing around and like waving his arms around and just doing a Carl Fitzpatrick kind of celebration, winding Paul Cullen up. So every time we played against him, Paul just wanted to get right into him and give him some stick. But you know what? For what he's achieved at Warrington, Carl, you know, he deserves a lot of recognition. I think he came to Warrington at one stage where he was working for free.
Yeah, he did.
And even then, you know, I think just to have him around, you know, he was such a great bloke. The experience of wealth that he had of Super League, his position that he played, he was helpful for me. And now, you know, him now CEO at Warrington. So, you know, fantastic. Credit to Carl.
I was just saying, as much as we Mickey take, we do like him.
I don't know if it was the 2005 season or maybe the 2006 season. I played Salford, I think I came off the bench and I got put down the wing and I stepped inside Carl and he just jumped up and took my head off.
Typical.
As being a young lad, he didn't care any less. He still took my head off. So I remember that very, very, very well.
Now we have to ask you as well, Chris, and we don't want to ask you this, but unfortunately we're going to. You played in two Super League grand finals. You're talking about being very confident going to Wembley and winning. Was that confidence still there before the grand finals? Was it a different psychology? Was it feeling different before you sort of stepped onto Old Trafford?
I think so, yeah. I think obviously the day is different. You know, the Challenge Cup's played at an early stage of the day in the daylight, cracking weather, where, you know, the grand finals played in colder weather at night time. So circumstances are different. Does that play part in it of us winning finals? I don't know. Could do. But I just think, like I alluded to earlier in this podcast, that I felt like we underachieved a little bit. I think the first final, I think we got ourselves in the lead. You know, we came up with a couple of plays or, you know, missed tackles, you know, that, you know, probably cost us a little bit in that second half. And the way Leeds controlled the game towards that second half, second period of the second half, and kicked us in the right areas and played us in the right areas. I just felt like Leeds showed us how to win a grand final. And then we played against Wigan in my time that was there, and we played really, really well. I think we weathered an early storm, and then we just seemed so in control, and we did really, really well. And I think I can't remember the score at the time, but I just felt like we were just so in control. And then we lost Joel Monaghan right in half time, which was a massive blow for us. And then I still felt comfortable. I know Wigan scored down my side just right before half time, but I still felt myself walking in at half time that we're still going to win this.
Right.
I still felt like we had that sort of mentality. We knew it was good enough. Do you know what I mean? We knew, but I think as the game progressed in that second half, I think there was a suspicious tackle from Hansen on Steph Ratchford. In my opinion, should have got sent off. Do I think it means any malice? I can't really say that. Only Harrison Hansen can ever answer them sort of questions. I think Wigan had a bit of a reputation for these sort of tackles and have been questioned over a few seasons. But for me, you know, that was kind of a turning point as well because we lost Steph there. And as always, you always have players that go into games with, you know, niggling injuries. We had, I think, you know, Ben Harrison and Gaz Carvel was carrying injuries. So I think the workload that was put on some of the players that was carrying injuries at the time really got to us in the end. I think we just ran out of steam. And, you know, I think we ended up with, at one stage, Lee Braze at fullback. It just turned into a bit of a mess in that second half. And I think out of the two finals, that's probably the one that we've probably got away more than the actual Leeds. I give Leeds a lot more credit for the way they kind of played in that final.
Do you think there's a little bit of difference in the style of play between winning a Challenge Cup and winning at Old Trafford, Chris? Because you've kind of touched on it there, that it's damp, it's wet, it's cold in October at Old Trafford. And then you've got this firm ground at Wembley earlier in the year. That Warrington team, to use the analogy, if you were sort of a horse in a horse race, you'd like the firm going, you'd like it hard going. You never suited that sort of heavy conditions, whereas Wigan possibly did, you know, a little bit more holding people up in the tackle, second man in, round the legs, etc. Under Steve Price now, he talks constantly about resilience. And there's been a lot of fans and a lot of criticism from listeners on the podcast that we're playing a little bit more of a mundane style. But is that possibly the style that you need to win the game in October? A little bit more of a grinding style than that fluent Libres, you know, along the line to you in the corner. Is it going to help being a little bit more resilient, so to speak?
You've got to have a bit of a mixed bag. You've got to be true to yourself and play the brand of rugby that you need to play. But I do certainly agree with the type of rugby that you need to play towards the back end of the season. I think you have got to be more resilient. The funny one with the Super League Grand Final, I felt like I was a bit more drained. I don't know if it's because of the lead-up, the time of the kickoff. And listen, this goes to both sides, so I can't say, you know, we've lost finals because of I felt more drained than they did. I think, like you said, the constant battle of, you know, being in the arm wrestle, giving yourself a chance towards the end of the game.
Yeah.
And I think it suits teams more when you're in that sort of game where you're still in it, but then you come up with a winning try.
Yeah,
you know,
I
remember watching the final when I wasn't at Warrington, when he got beat by Wigan. The Wigan winger went over in the corner.
Manfredi,
yeah. You know, I think if you give yourself a chance, you know, I think we've lost finals, you know, quite early on in the second half and not being able to pull it back. So, you know, I think if you do give yourself a chance and change that sort of rugby, because, you know, in the season when it's, you know, cracking up, the flags are cracking, the sun's out, you can throw them balls around, you can kick the balls perfect for, you know, Matt King and John Monaghan. You know, the likes of Ryan Atkins can burst through lines and putting people through. So, no, that's fantastic. But I think you have, towards the back end of the season, got to mix up a little bit and show a bit of resilience, a bit of grit, a bit of determination and get the job done.
It's them shitty in goal areas. That's what really gets me at Old Trafford. I mean, if you think about it, you know, as a winger, if you've got a team who are playing and, like, you know, maybe you've based your game on kicking for the winger, you know, in the in goal, it has to change the game, or it becomes all about how good the kicker is at that particular point. So I think it does dramatically affect it. And for you as well, Chris, as a winger, it must, like, you know, change your game. I mean, you mustn't feel comfortable running 100 miles an hour diving into one of them corners, because you're going to go straight into the hoardings. That's what I keep thinking.
What do you make of the team at the moment, Chris? What are your sort of thoughts on how they're playing and where we're at? I mean, I know obviously now it's been, you know, bizarre with all this going on, but start of the season, think they were going quite well?
It's a different team to, you know, when I was involved and when we had that, you know, a bit of early success. With maybe another addition, I think maybe a little bit light in the pack.
I've
seen the new player that they signed.
Latu. Yep.
I was walking around Vicky Park and there was a reserve grade on, so me and the girls went and watched it for a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, it seems a big plodder, and, you know, I'm not too sure if he's ready for, you know, the Super League or not, but, you know, I think just missing that one big player, maybe, you know, a bit of a grub, maybe, you know, a tough player.
Yeah.
You know, the loss of Benny Westwood, you know, he could come up with a crunching tackle, or, you know, a big play when you needed, you know, the likes of someone like Louis Anderson, you know, plays like that, you just need in your team. I think when you look at the Warrington team, they miss, you know, really, really tough play in that sort of aspect. But that's not saying that they haven't got tough players. I think they really have. They've got some great players. But I just feel like they're just missing maybe that one or two players like that who could just come up with a massive tackle and just change the game on its head. Or, you know, even if it's, you know, like I said, Benny Westwood just to take players' heads off left, right and centre. He wasn't always the best tackle in the world. But, you know, he kind of got us revved up and stuff, and he kind of changed games when it needed to be done.
Have you been out to his food emporium?
I have, yeah.
What do you recommend, Chris? What's the signature dish out there?
He talked about his sausages.
Oh.
I'm not a big sausage fan. I'll eat sausages, but I'm more of a bacon and egg fan, man. So I had that, and it was very nice. So he would recommend his sausages. So if you'd ever round Warrington and see Benny Westwood's food emporium, I'd definitely try that.
We'll get over there. Now, you just talked about, you know, Warrington having formidable players. Who was the one winger you didn't want to come up against? There must have been one that you thought, oh, not him again. Who was the lad that you most sort of feared?
I really struggled against the likes of Pat Richards. I think the sheer height, when you look at Joel Panahan and the tries that he scored from jumping.
Yeah.
I think the likes of me, the mental challenge and the physical challenge that I had to go up against Pat Richards was tough. But, you know, I played against the likes of Semi Tajilala, who was just a ball of muscle. And the funny thing about Sven Kedlar as well, he'd oil his legs up as well.
Right.
I'm not going up high on him. He'll just bounce me off. So I'll grab his legs instead. But he'd also oil his legs up as well. So he'd end up going sliding off him. But,
oh, dear.
You know, people like that. Funny enough, I played against Bradford. I came off the bench for Richard Barnett. And it was only like 5 to 10 minutes to go. And I went up against Leslie Van Der Kolo. So you can imagine. Skinny Chris Riley versus the man mountain.
You'd only make up one of his legs, wouldn't you?
Lucky enough, I only had to tackle him once, but I pretty much got a piggyback for 10 yards.
Did you? But you got him down, mate. You got him down.
We got him down. I didn't personally get him down. We had about 5 players on him. I was on his back.
Well, Chris, it's been a pleasure having you on. Keep up the terrific work you're doing in your job. And not only here at the podcast, would we like to say what a wonderful player you were, but also what a big-hearted human being you are too. All the very best.
Cheers, guys. Thank you very much. I wish you all the best with the podcast.
I got a feeling that tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good, good night. I feel it. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good night.